Well, I am very, very lucky to have in studio a friend who only makes it back to Maui, but if we're lucky, once a year, John Neff, a radio professional and an amazing engineer. And on top of that, someone who has quite a history with doing movies and soundtracks for movies and has worked with David Lynch. Quite amazing background that you've had. Of course, you had that studio you work with upcountry with the members of Steely Dan, and Willie Nelson was in there, and a lot of things. You don't live on Maui anymore, but you feel like it's your spiritual home, right?
That's exactly correct.
Yeah, and I can understand that. I have to say it's gotten a lot more expensive to live on Maui than when you lived here.
Yes.
Yeah, when you think back, how did that studio upcountry get started?
Well, let me go back to where I met Walter.
Okay.
I was doing the morning show at KVIB, the old country station that is now KDLX.
Uh-huh.
And the Pacific Whale Foundation was sending in a spokesman to talk about Whale Day.
Uh-huh.
And so the traffic person called me up on the intercom and said that my guest was here. And so I said, send him back. I was expecting Kaufman from the Pacific.
Yeah, Greg Kaufman, yeah.
Greg, that was his first name. And I opened the studio door, and there is standing Walter Becker. And I said, I know you. And he says, no, I only look like him. He says, don't use my name. I'm just here to speak for the whales.
Really?
Yeah. So he came in, and he did the spiel. And
was he playing at the gig or anything?
No. Oh. He was just a spokesman for Pacific Whale Foundation.
Wow.
And he came in. He wanted to stay after the presentation and pick records. We had a big U-shaped console in the studio with tape recorders and cart decks and turntables and all the stuff that we don't use anymore. And underneath it, in two layers, was thousands of albums. So Walter sat on the floor and held up a disc and would say, side two, track three.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was playing LPs, and he was programming the show. And the station manager came in after a while. He was driving in and heard all this weird music and came in and busted right into the studio and while a record was playing, and said, what's going on? And I said, Walter is picking the music. And he says, who is that? And I said, that's Walter Becker from Steely Dan. And he says, put him on the air, put him on the air. And I said, he just was speaking for the Pacific Whale Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, okay, well, let him do that. And he came back and did it again at Ko'oi when I was here. And he was a ghost DJ. And so
I didn't
know
that story. I never heard
that. Yeah, so we became friends from 1982. And in 1989, he came into my small Dairy Road studio, and he said, are you doing any business here? And I said, oh, yeah, I had a Hawaiian record label. I was producing a lot of albums there in a very small studio. And he said, let's go build a real studio. This place is too small.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really? I was stunned. And he said, yes. So we went out. We looked at the old Kula Theater. We looked at property all over the island and finally settled on 7 acres in Ulupalakua.
Wow.
That was owned by his wife then.
Can you imagine how much that would cost now?
Oh, this cost quite a bit to put in this studio. I don't want to name a figure, but it was a very expensive studio to build. We had a Los Angeles studio architect design it, and we had a wonderful local crew building it. But the funny thing was, I lived in Kaokea, and the studio was in Ulupalakua, and I would be driving out to the studio during construction, and if I saw big waves, a bunch of white caps down on the ocean, I knew I wouldn't have a crew because they'd all be surfing.
I believe that. And you know what's amazing? It got the reputation of the best studio on the island, of course. But when you've told me stories about what it was like, and I was not aware what perfectionists both Donald Fagen and Walter Becker were in the studio, that they had a very, very high standard.
Yes.
That they wanted maintained in recording, right?
The day before we started Donald's Comic Heriad album, Walter took me aside and he said, "Now, there's going to be a lot of egos in the control room, and half of them are Donald." And he said, "So just if he wants to do something, let him do it. Don't interrupt him, you know, these sorts of things." He says, "Donald slices a finer hair."
Mm-hmm. I like that. And those were the days of splices when we actually used razor blades, wasn't it?
Oh, that was, we were on tape, 32-track digital tape recorder. Wow. Pro Tools didn't exist yet.
Yeah, before that. And then you told me a story that blew my mind at the end when you were going to close the studio down, which must have been heartbreaking, how you were told to throw out tons of tapes that he didn't want, out tracks, etc. And that stuck with me when I heard that story.
When I was closing my Derry Road studio, he came in with a pickup truck full of tapes, and it was all Steely Dan outtakes, alternate mixes, songs you've never heard. And I had the first DAT recorder in Maui. And so we made Donald and Walter a DAT of the things that they wanted to keep. I held the phone up to the big monitor speakers and would play a song for Donald in New York. And then he'd get on the phone and talk with Walter and decide yes or no whether to keep it or not. But so I made these two DAT tapes for them of the songs they wanted to keep a record of. And then Walter said, "Now I want you to take apart the tape reels and cut the tape off the thing and throw it in the dumpster."
Ouch. Ouch, you know.
And I couldn't do it for a few days.
I'm sure. It would be hard. Some of that stuff, and you know and I know, after someone passes away, how you go back and years later. I think Prince is just coming out with a tape that was never released. I mean, for years later, even Jimi Hendrix, they found years and years later stuff that was from Electric Ladyland back in the vaults, right?
Yep.
But I mean, obviously they didn't want that to happen. It was a clear-cut choice.
They said to me during the evaluation week, they said, "We released all the good stuff."
Hmm. But now even the Stones, right? Coming back with stuff they said they, and you wonder, maybe it isn't the best stuff, but still, it's better than a lot of other stuff, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you got to wonder. When did you leave Maui the first time? I guess you moved to Seattle?
No, I moved to Phoenix. Walter bought me out of the studio. We got busted for a zoning violation, and he took it private. I was doing Buffy St. Marie, Buddy Foe. I was doing Over the Edge, Hawaiian albums. I did the Pahinui Brothers, and those were all commercial projects. We got popped for a zoning violation, and I had to stop doing that. And Walter bought me out, and I moved to Phoenix and built, with the same architect, the same LA studio architect, I built a big studio in a former television studio in Phoenix, and it was called Lone Cactus Records, and Lone Cactus Studio, but there wasn't enough business in Phoenix to support a big studio.
And now there is. Do you think of Alice Cooper lives there, and all the other people that do live there now? It's become so big in Phoenix now.
Yes, but I was there in '93,
and
I was just too premature.
Yeah.
For that, anybody with money went to L.A.
Amazing. And all that money.
But then I went to work for the architect. That studio went under. Then I went to work for that architect in Los Angeles, moved there, and did the technical designs for studios all over the world.
Hmm.
And David Lynch was my client.
Mm-hmm.
And when I installed his studio, he said, "You're the only one that knows how this place works. You're going to have to run it."
That's always been the greatest idea. You know, we have engineers. You remember Alex Kowalski? You know?
Oh, I remember him well. God bless him.
He was an engineer here for 46 years. I mean, from the very beginning. And only he knew how some of the wires and the things and how they connected, et cetera, you know?
Yep.
And if you're an engineer, you have job security to a degree because of that. But then how do you deal with someone like David Lynch, who's not your average person?
Well, he's actually a very normal guy.
Is he really?
Yeah. It looks like, and he acts like he's right out of the 50s. You know, one of his sayings, if he likes something, he'll go aces or hot dog. But he had a clear vision of what he wanted his studio to do. He wanted to be able to mix films in 5.1 surround, record music. There was a big enough recording space between the console and the movie screen to put in a small orchestra, and we scored the Straight Story there.
Wow.
Three isolation rooms, three 35-millimeter projectors, plus a digital projector.
That's massive.
Yeah, it was a $3 million studio.
Where was that?
Hollywood Hills.
Oh, really? In the Hollywood Hills?
He has three houses in a row. A Lloyd Wright house, not Frank Lloyd Wright, but his son.
Uh-huh.
A Lloyd Wright house, and then a second house uphill from it that is offices and film editorial. It's where the film editing station is. And then the third house was used for filming Lost Highway. It was the set. And then we demolished about half of the house and bored back into the hillside and reconstructed the building as the recording studio and David's painting studio.
Where is that now? I grew up in the Hollywood Hills. I live up Sunset and Doheny up there, but I'm sure
just off Outpost.
Outpost is towards the Benedict Canyon? No.
No, it's right by the Hollywood Bowl overlook on Mulholland Drive.
Oh, yeah, right up there is beautiful. Yeah, very nice. That's amazing. I mean, so that was a gig that kind of led you into another phase of your life.
It put me in the film business.
Yeah, which is not an easy business. I mean, you're dealing with another whole animal when you're doing the soundtracks than you are for doing an album. And, you know, strangely enough, John, the real money now for musicians comes from soundtracks. Most musicians can't make as much, unless you're huge, as a person doing soundtracks for movies.
I had four pieces of music in Mulholland Drive, and I still get royalties on that.
That's wonderful.
And I had music in the return of Twin Peaks 4 years ago.
Now, how did you get involved in Twin Peaks, and how did that happen, and did you have to move to make that happen?
I did not have to move. It was a song that David and I had recorded back in 2002 with Rebecca Del Rio called No Stars, and it went in episode 10 of Twin Peaks, The Return, which was on Showtime 4 years ago, and it was well-received. Rebecca and I have performed that song a couple of times live at the Twin Peaks Festival. And
which no longer happens now.
Yeah, yeah, the CBS pulled the license.
How come?
I don't know. They wanted to do some Twin Peaks events themselves. And so they pulled the license for the UK Fest and for the United States Fest.
Where was that held, the United States
in Fest? In North Bend and Snoqualmie, in the filming locations in Washington State.
What was it like going there for those events? Because there was a huge fan base. It was kind of a cult fan base, wasn't it?
Still is.
Yeah.
The Twin Peaks Festival was absolutely wonderful. I went for many years. I performed at it 5 times, and it was a fan gathering. They'd have 15, 18 cast members.
Did you get to actually stay at the hotel where some of this stuff was shot?
Yes, the Salish Hotel overlooking Snoqualmie Falls.
I think I saw a picture once you took from there when you were staying there for that.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So was it weird being in the hotel where you, was it kind of like a movie brought to life, being in the hotel with some of the cast members wandering around?
We would assemble in, they have an attic lounge, and after the day's festivities, we would assemble there at night and have a couple of libations and some poo-poos. And the general public was there, too. The fans would hang out outside the hotel to get autographs as cast members came in and out.
Amazing.
That sort of thing. But
is that place, the hotel, still there?
Oh, yeah. It's
so
owned by
stay?
The Salish tribe.
There's an Indian tribe that own it.
Yes.
Well, they made some good money on that then.
Yes.
And probably all because of Twin Peaks.
Well, it's a famous resort unto itself.
Oh, is it?
It has a world-famous spa.
I didn't know that.
And its location right at the top of the falls is beautiful. So it's a very famous hotel to begin with.
Is it hard to get to? How would you get there? Through Seattle?
Yes.
And then drive?
And then drive to about a half an hour, 35 minutes to North Bend.
I thought it was way out there because it felt so way out. It felt so way out while you're watching. It's like, wow, this is pretty far out. I mean, you know, we were from the age of pretty far out, right? but David Lynch was one of the first people to act on some of those ways of thinking that kind of were hard to follow at some times until you went into another dimension. He actually brought in kind of different dimensions within one or two scenes, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. So David is an abstract expressionist painter.
Mm.
He paints 8 or 10 major paintings a year.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He's exhibited worldwide. And he doesn't sell them, though. It's going to be worth a fortune when he dies.
Yeah.
But, sorry, David. But,
you think he carries that same vibe, his mind, into what he was doing with his scripts?
Yes, he's very surrealistic.
He is, indeed.
In his art.
I think people understood and loved for that, because you didn't often see that, right?
No, his films are art films. They're not Hollywood mainstream films by any means.
You had an interesting experience with him once in France, once or twice. You were able to go to Cannes.
Yes.
Had you ever been to Cannes before? And there was David Lynch and the whole entourage there as well?
It was. It was the main stars, David's wife, who was the film's editor, myself, Angelo Badalamenti, the composer of the score, and Peter Deming, the cinematographer. We all went to the Cannes Film Festival for the premiere in the Grand Palais, which occurred at 10:30 at night, after a wonderful dinner and a lot of Lynch Bage wine put on by Studio Canal, and showed the film.
This was from Mulholland Drive.
Showed the film, mm-hmm. And we got a 10-minute standing ovation at the end of it.
Did that just blow your mind?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that what an amazing moment in time and history. Was David even surprised, you think?
Yes, I do, because he was booed when he took Wild at Heart there in 1990.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
My God.
And you told me earlier that when we were talking about this, Mulholland Drive's going to be re-released now.
Yes, a new Criterion Ultra 4K release, a big collector's box.
Won't that be something? My gosh.
Yeah, they've done a frame-by-frame rescan, high def of the negative, and remastered my 5.1 mix. And so that comes out within weeks.
That's so thrilling. You also got to actually do, you were doing a concert, I think, on stage once there. Weren't you supposed to be scheduled to do an on-stage performance with him?
Yes. David and I have an album out called Blue Bob. It was released in 2001 and sold on his website only, and then a French label picked it up and released it in 13 European and Scandinavian countries on November 11th, 2002. So that very day, we played, we assembled a band, because David and I played all the instruments on the record. We assembled a band, including wonderful players, and rehearsed for a little while in Hollywood, and then rehearsed for a week in Paris.
You flew everyone out to Paris for this?
Yeah, business class.
Wow.
Air Tahiti Nui.
Oh.
And which is a great airline, by the way. I'll plug them.
This is in Paris?
In Paris. We played the Olympia Theater.
Oh, my God. That's a famous theater.
Yeah. And Beth Gibbons from Portishead opened for us.
What was that like with the French audience? It's a different audience in France, right?
Oh, it was wonderful. I've played Europe before, back in the 70s. But this was 2,500 people in the theater, standing room only. When David had made a blue square and then a sign that said Bob, and we hired two French models to walk out of the curtain with these signs, and as soon as they walked out, the audience, I told David, I said, be ready for a roar. It's like a freight train.
Yeah.
It's the biggest rush you'll ever have. And sure enough, those girls went out through the curtains, and the audience erupted.
Wow.
Just erupted. And I looked over at Dave, and I said, well, here we go. And we did our show.
What does David play?
He plays guitar on his lap. He plays it in a very unconventional method, not like Jeff Healey used to, but David uses the tremolo bar as a melodic device. He'll hit a note or a chord and then bend it with the whammy bar to make melodies.
So did you improvise around that?
Yes.
I wrote
chordal arrangements, and then David would improvise basically on top of my arrangements.
Amazing. And so when you look back at all these interesting things, you know, it came back and we go back to the very beginning of your roots in Detroit. And you were, what an amazing beginning from Detroit, having a hit at the age of 15.
Yes.
From a piece you wrote in your garage with a literal garage band, right?
Oh, yeah.
Before all the equipment was called and there was GarageBand. This was a GarageBand. And how did you even get that from your GarageBand out? Did you spend a lot of money to get your own recording out of that and then take it to the radio station yourself?
My dad paid for the session. He thought it was cute that we were writing our own songs at 14.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the audiovisual and printing business. So he had an in at a good studio, and he pressed records at Columbia Special Products in Chicago for his business. So he had a relationship with them. So he pressed 500 copies of this 45, and we put them in on consignment in record stores. And we went and played a sock hop. If you remember those, you take your shoes off and you go dance on the high school basketball floor. And we played a sock hop at Notre Dame High School in Detroit with the Capitals, who had Cool Jerk out right then, and the Shades of Blue, who had Oh How Happy out. And then I had given, they had a WXYZ, the big AM station in Detroit, he had a kiosk in there, and the DJ was spinning records when the bands weren't playing. Well, I walked over and handed him our single. And we thought the song that my bass player wrote was the A side and that my song was the B side. But the DJ previewed it and played my side.
Which was called?
So Good.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't. But it was successful.
Uh-huh.
And all the kids got up and danced to the record. And so we had, and we played our set, and we played both of our songs. And we had quite a discussion in the band about, now it looks like the A-side is my song.
Mm-hmm.
And so WXYZ played it.
Wow.
And then CKLW in Windsor, which is a 50,000-watt AM flamethrower, picked it up, and we ended up getting hired to open for the Turtles at Cobo Hall in Detroit.
Oh,
at 15 years of age.
Amazing. That must have been so memorable. There was a lot of amazing Detroit history. So you hung out in Detroit till?
1975, I moved to Toronto. I was there for about 18 months, and then I moved back to Michigan for a little bit. I still had a home, sold my home, and moved to Phoenix.
Ah, and from Phoenix, how did you get to Maui?
I went from Phoenix to Maui.
Amazing.
I married a girl whose family lived here.
Oh,
we came here on our honeymoon for 2 weeks. A friend of her parents loaned us a Volkswagen Thing, and we went all around the island, really, really abused that poor car. And went back to the mainland, and within a few weeks, I had put up 8x10 photos in my office of, like, the rainbow eucalyptus trees, waterfalls on the way to Hana, the crater, beaches, and we had a discussion one night and said, neither one of us was doing real well at that time. I had just quit touring. And we said, what the heck? Why don't we just move to Maui? You know, and her mother found us a house on Crater Road. It was the last house on Crater Road.
Wow.
And we were there for 4 years and then moved on. But it was just a wonderful time. That was 1979. Maui was a different place.
A totally, totally different place. And then you had just a recent major move. Your studio, you sold out. The studio was where?
In Portland.
In Portland. And you decided to sell everything off.
I turned 70 in March. I've been working in studios for 56 years, since I was 14.
Mm.
And that's enough.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to travel while I still could.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting a little feeble in my old age. And I had an illness this year and lost 48 pounds. But
you're doing good now.
Yeah, I am doing good now. I had an operation a little over a month ago.
Yeah.
And things are fine. I'm able to eat again. And
But unfortunately, you decided to sell all your
stuff.
Oh,
so yeah, I had 47 guitars. I sold 42 of them.
Wow.
All the studio gear, 26 keyboards, 24 antique tube amps, 80 microphones, even sold the console, the furniture, the acoustic treatments off the walls. I left an empty building.
Wow. Quite a huge, huge project. You kept one guitar that had a special feeling that was signed by Willie Nelson.
Yes. Willie came up to the Ulupalakua studio and did a record with me in December of 1990. And his guitar was seized by the IRS in that whole tax mess. And I loaned him my 1972 Martin D41 guitar, which is the second from the top model that they make. And we made the record. And I told him to keep the guitar for a while till it was resolved what was going to happen with Trigger. And so he kept the guitar 6 months and brought it back up to the Ulupalakua studio and said, John, that's a real fine guitar. I've got to give you something for it. I had it a long time. And I said, no, I won't take any money. It's one musician helping another. And I pulled out a Sharpie pen and handed him the guitar. And I said, would you sign it? Start my Trigger. And so he did. He signed it.
That's so cool. And you've kept it.
Oh, yeah. It goes to my daughter when I pass.
Such great history. Well, you're working on a book?
Yes. It's called Greetings from Sodom, Life in the Underbelly of Rock and Roll.
I can't wait to read it. I can't wait to read it. It's got some amazing history. You've had quite an amazing journey. And I'm glad you were able to come in studio and we could talk story here face to face.
Thank you. I worked with Journey, too.
There you go, right?
I did their Revelation album, the first one with Arnell.
In Los Angeles?
I did it in Sausalito at the record plant.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Amazing. Well, hey, thank you so much for
thank
coming
you.
In, John Neff, and happy trails.
Mahalo.
Mahalo.